I thought I'd start just by saying something about review papers in general. The idea of a review paper is to make sense of the literature. Some areas in the literature are vast, and clinicians and other researchers even find it extremely useful to read a good review of an area, to put it in context and to make sense, and especially to update people with developments. Reviews can be extremely useful. Certainly, they're able to tell us what we know and what there's agreement on, but even more usefully, perhaps they highlight the areas where there's debate or even where there's major disagreement, and that can point the way to where future studies might be directed. So all reviews start with a predefined question, and reviews will generally, what they should do really, state what their eligibility criteria that determine which, you know, what the criteria are for including studies or for excluding studies. So, for example, you could have a study of amblyopia that might focus on the treatment effects in strabismic amblyopic children. So, therefore, studies of different types of amblyopia or studies of amblyopic adults wouldn't be included. But it's stated up front as to what precisely the target area is. I think it's worth distinguishing between narrative reviews and systematic reviews. Narrative reviews are generally the way that reviews used to be carried out. The reviewer is free in a narrative review to select the references that either support or refute their argument. And so the idea is that the reviewer has an argument that they're trying to develop and is potentially able to cherry-pick the studies that they would like to use to support their argument or to refute somebody else's argument, much the same way as a barrister might do in the legal profession. Those reviews are generally less favored nowadays because they're prone to bias, and they've been replaced by systematic reviews, which are much harder to carry out, much harder to write, and some would say also much harder to read than narrative reviews. So, what's a systematic review? A systematic review aims to look at all of the literature, or at least all trials that have features of a randomized controlled trial. So, the idea is to avoid cherry picking or dismissing studies that don't support an argument, because at the outset, the systematic review, like all reviews, will say precisely what the question is that's being addressed, and it'll say in detail as well what the eligibility criteria are. It'll say what search terms were used, what search engines were used, whether literature in languages other than English were searched. And so the idea is you kind of set your stall out very clearly in advance, and then whatever studies emerge as a result of that search with those criteria are addressed. They can't be dismissed, and there's a very clear indication as to how many items or how many publications showed up, how many of those were included, and then a detailed account of why certain studies perhaps were later excluded. But the idea is that it's all very transparent in terms of what was or wasn't included. In a systematic review, priority is given to studies that are at low risk of bias. This is bias not in the way in which we might generally use that word bias, but bias in the statistical sense, and I'll say more about that in a little bit. But this is because studies that are at high risk of bias have been found to exaggerate treatment effects or even to suggest that treatment effects exist when they don't at all. So that's the difference in narrative and systematic reviews. Next, I'd like to say something just about a meta-analysis, because meta-analysis and systematic reviews often come together, although they don't have to. So we've said that a systematic review answers a defined research question by collecting and summarizing the evidence that fits pre-specified eligibility criteria. But a meta-analysis goes beyond that because it uses statistical methods to summarize the results of the studies that have been identified by the systematic review. So a meta-analysis is a quantitative aspect, it's a quantitative addition to a systematic review. So it comes at the end of a systematic review, it comes and it's based upon the publications, the literature that have been identified by a systematic review. So a meta-analysis always accompanies a systematic review, but a systematic review doesn't necessarily have to include a meta-analysis. And that was a situation that applied with our recent systematic review on the effect of color and on the ability to read. Typically, but not necessarily, the study is based on randomized controlled trials. The meta-analysis study is based on randomized controlled trials. So again, like systematic review, and as I say, as an adjunct to systematic review, a meta-analysis is a tool that's trying to help us make sense of the published literature. And the idea is that studies that are at low risk of bias, are, and provided they're homogeneous, in other words, on the same treatment effect, for example, looking at the same treatment effect in the same condition, the idea is that we can aggregate the results from different studies and try and figure out overall what does the literature say as to whether a particular intervention is effective or not. And it can try and arrive at a sort of a global statistic as to what the likelihood is that there is a treatment effect at all, and if there is, what the size of the treatment effect might be. I'd like to turn now just to say something about statistics, not just in relation to review papers, but in relation to statistics in general. When we conducted our review, we identified an overemphasis on statistical significance testing in many of the papers. Statistical significance really should be the final stage in an experiment, and it should only really proceed when all of the data have been collected and when the study is complete. And I'm raising this point really because if there are problems with the study that exist, for example, in relation to the study design or in how the study was carried out, that could have major implications. That could be a major source of bias. However, if the statistical testing proceeds and reaches this magical criterion where the p-value is stated and the p-value turns out to be less than 0.05, which is the generally accepted criterion in statistical significance testing, then conclusions can be drawn. But when a closer examination of the study and of the results is undertaken, perhaps it's the case that that actually is ill-advised to even perhaps conduct statistical significance testing in the first place. Take, for example, a study in which there are 100 participants. If at the end of the study only 50% of the participants are left and statistical significance testing is carried out and found to show that the treatment intervention is statistically significant because p is less than 0.05, well, that could be a very unsound basis on which to draw conclusions about the strength of the treatment effect, because perhaps the 50% who were lost would have showed a totally different effect or dropped out perhaps because the treatment was not working for them, for example. Meta-analysis, of course, also is a statistical approach, and meta-analysis generates plots, generally known as forest plots, which again help to make sense of the data. But again, the idea is that meta-analysis is only conducted on studies that have been found to be at low risk of bias. And I'm going to say something more about what those bias areas are just now. But just to sum up this part about statistics, the American Statistical Association has raised very, very significant concerns at the way statistical significance testing is being misused. And it's true that some journals don't even report the results of those tests because of the possibility that statistics can basically be misused. So some journals are suggesting that instead they would prefer a very, very detailed methodology, so it's absolutely transparent as to how the study was conducted in all its aspects. And then at the end, the treatment group, for example, and the no treatment group, what's reported for those are the means and the 95% confidence intervals, which just allow the reader to make their own inference about just how different the two groups are. I'd like to just say something about the Cochrane collaboration, because that bears down a little bit on our review. The Cochrane collaboration is a not-for-profit organization that conducts systematic reviews, and its aim is to highlight the best research that's available. And in some cases, in many cases, in fact, it's been highlighting interventions for which there's no good quality data. So there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of Cochrane systematic reviews have been conducted. And in the area of vision and eyes, and there are many, many systematic reviews. So there's a Cochrane review, systematic review on treatment, non-surgical treatment for convergence insufficiency, many, many on interventions for amblyopia, several for macular disease. Now, we didn't conduct a Cochrane review, but we used Cochrane review methodology, and that's why I'm introducing it here. So, as we've said, a central feature of any systematic review should be the approach that's used to examine the literature for bias elements that are likely to exaggerate the effect of a treatment or perhaps even introduce one when none exists. So in Cochrane, there's a very well-defined approach that should be taken to investigating the likelihood that bias exists, and they call it the risk of bias tool. And we use this tool in conducting our systematic review. So the systematic review approach we took using the Cochrane risk of bias tool assesses whether there's bias in a whole range of different areas. And I'll just give one or two examples of those. But the idea in each of the different areas is that the reviewers conducting this systematic review look at each of the different bias areas and make a judgment as to whether that particular published paper is at low risk of bias, is at high risk of bias, or has an unclear risk of bias. So one of the bias areas is performance bias, and that's described by Cochrane as bias that could arise from study personnel knowing which intervention a participant received. So for example, in relation to colored lenses, if there are placebo lenses and lenses that are matched to the color that are the so-called correct color, if the participant knows that they have received placebo lenses versus the correct color, then that's a performance bias. Or if the personnel know which color is a placebo versus the correct color, that's performance bias. Another area is detection bias, and that's whether or not the people who are assessing the outcome, for example, measuring reading speed, if they know which intervention a participant received or happens to be looking through when the reading measures, for example, have been taken. Yet another area of bias that would attract a judgment of high, low, or unclear is attrition bias. And attrition is dropout from the study. So if there's a high rate of attrition, then the likelihood is that the reviewers would judge that study is at high risk of attrition bias. If, on the other hand, a study starts with X number of participants and ends up with very, very close to X number of participants at the end, then the study has lost few participants and the study would be at low risk of attrition bias. Another area is reporting bias. It's possible, it's common in fact, that researchers might take a very selective approach to reporting their data and what they have found, and the reviewers in a systematic review would also look closely to see to what extent that may have occurred and again assign a judgment of high, low, or unclear risk of bias. When a systematic review has been conducted, good practice is that at least two reviewers would independently look at each published item that has been identified as meeting the inclusion criteria. And in the different areas, in relation to reporting bias, attrition bias, performance bias, they would each independently come to a judgment as to whether that paper had a high risk, a low risk, or an unclear risk of bias in relation to reporting, in relation to attrition, in relation to performance, and so on. And then a central feature of this systematic review is the table that appears, because the table shows exactly which studies were included, exactly what the judgments were in each of the different areas, and very importantly, why those judgments were arrived at. And the idea is that it's open and transparent to anybody reading the review as to why those judgments were made. The reader might disagree with those, but at least they know the basis on which those judgments were made. So it's all very, very open. So turning now to what we found in our review using the Cochrane risk of bias tool. We found, when we looked at the literature, that there are many claims in published studies. And of course, there are many anecdotal claims that color helps reading performance in individuals who are struggling with reading. But when we subjected the literature that met our eligibility criteria, we found that the vast majority of studies were at high or uncertain risk of bias. And those that were at lower risk of bias were less supportive of the usefulness of color to aid reading. One question that readers of our review may have had is why we didn't conduct a meta-analysis. We didn't conduct a meta-analysis because we found that the majority of studies were at higher on certain risk of bias. Meta-analysis can only proceed if there are studies at low risk of bias, and those studies are homogeneous. It's not accepted practice, it's not good practice for certain, to combine data from studies at high risk of bias, because that will still result in a conclusion that's at a high risk of bias. And this was particularly problematic for studies of intuitive overlays and precision tinted lenses and the other color schemes investigated in our review. because they were very frequently at risk of bias, high risk of bias or uncertain risk of bias in a number of domains, but most especially in relation to the lack of masking. Participants were almost always aware of whether or not they were looking through the placebo lens or whether or not they were looking through the so-called correct colored lens overlay. Another problem with combining data for different studies, in our review, was that there were no consistent diagnostic criterion for diagnosing visual stress. We didn't look in visual stress in its own right. We looked at whether or not color aided reading, but many of the studies, of course, that we looked at had identified their participants as having visual stress, and there was certainly a wide range of diagnostic criterion used to diagnose visual stress in that body of literature. So, our conclusion in the systematic review is that the evidence showing that color aids reading performance is weak or non-existent. That may sound like a stark conclusion and that we've taken a very hardline position, but virtually every other review, and that includes many recent reviews, have arrived at exactly the same conclusion. And in the discussion section of our paper, we refer to those other review papers and indicate how closely aligned with their conclusions the results of our systematic review are. What's the way forward then? Because obviously our position differs from others in the field. Is there a way forward in which this area can develop in a research sense, and whether we can conduct future studies to address this question? So in our review, we said that the evidence was extremely weak or non-existent to support the use of color to aid reading performance. However, lack of evidence to show that color helps reading is not the same as saying that color does not help. We talk about this point in detail in the discussion paper, and I would refer anybody to that very, very important aspect of the outcome of our systematic review. I think everybody in the area accepts, even the main proponents of the use of color, accept that the diagnostic criteria for visual stress are extremely weak, that the control trials that have been conducted are lacking in scientific rigor and need to be conducted with greater rigor. And I think there is a way forward. I think the way forward is to adopt a very rigorous scientific approach in which agreement is reached on the trial methodology, which is pre-registered. Also pre-registered would be the outcome measures and the proposed statistical approaches and analysis. In other words, everything is set out up front as to how the trial is to be conducted, who's to be recruited, what would constitute evidence that colored lenses or colored filters are improving symptoms of visual stress or are improving reading performance. Of course, this study would have to have a precisely defined research question also. So what is the way forward? Everybody in the area, even the people who are most supportive of the use of color, agree, I think, that the diagnostic criteria for visual stress are extremely weak and that much better evidence needs to be gathered to support the use of color, if indeed color has a beneficial effect. Research needs to be conducted, and it needs to be conducted with scientific rigor in a way perhaps that our systematic review has highlighted where the literature is weak. The way forward is to identify a research question that is clear and accepted as the question, the correct question to ask. Then to pre-register, identify in advance the trial methodology, the trial outcome measures, and the proposed statistical approaches and analysis to be used. This is extremely important to do that. There are lots of accusations in the literature, not just in this area, but in scientific literature in general, that unless, for example, statistical approaches are specified in advance, that there's the possibility that post-hoc data trawling will take place in order to identify statistically significant effects. And we've already said what the dangers of relying just upon statistics are in relation to examining treatment outcomes. So the way forward is to take away the suggestion that there's any post-hoc approach to arriving at a conclusion, that it's all specified in advance. So precisely how the trial is to be conducted would be set out in advance and agreed. And if that agreement could be reached by people on both sides of the argument, and then the trial was conducted in an appropriate fashion and verified, the outcome measures were agreed in advance and again were gathered, statistics and the reporting, then hopefully that would end up with a study which would be judged to be at low risk of bias in all areas. And that would count as the scientific evidence that we currently are greatly lacking in this area.